Hello, I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Major support for Classical Music Connection is provided by Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. Now, let's find out what's on today's program. In the April 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, Brian Wise brings us a little history of the encore. Sometimes an encore outshines the concert preceding it. Such was the case at a recital last October in Parma, Italy, when the soprano Lisette Oropesa decided to add a fourth unrehearsed encore to her program. A problem loomed. The selection Sempre Libera from Verdi's La Traviata requires a tenor, which had not been arranged. Sensing the impending void, Liu Zhongwei, a music student from a nearby conservatory, rose from his seat in the auditorium and belted out the offstage tenor part to the apparent delight of Oropesa and the audience. Audience video captured the moment, and clips soon ricocheted across social media, YouTube, and TikTok. Liu later met Oropesa backstage and offered what turned out to be an unnecessary apology. The French word encore, meaning literally again, first appeared in English in the early 18th century, used by audiences of Italian opera in London. It was simply the repetition of a selection, aria, overture, that had garnered enough applause to be performed again. But over time, some encores have risen to sensational status on their own. Consider one that pianist Rudolf Serkin gave in Berlin in 1921. The formal program had ended with a crowd-pleasing rendition of Bach's fifth Brandenburg Concerto, complete with a blazing cadenza. Backstage, violinist Adolf Busch urged Serkin to perform an encore. "What shall I play?" the 18-year-old Serkin asked. "The Goldberg Variations," Busch replied jokingly. The pianist took him at his word and delivered Bach's entire work. Serkin later recalled that the only remaining audience members were Busch and his wife, the pianist Arthur Schnabel, and the musicologist Alfred Einstein. A very different element of surprise colored the encores given in 1951 by Renata Tabaldi during a joint recital with Maria Callas in Rio de Janeiro. The sopranos had agreed that neither would upstage the other by performing encores. But Tabaldi gave not one, but two. As the story goes, Callas later berated Tabaldi publicly at a dinner party, referencing a recent flop in Italy and setting off a long-standing rivalry. 18th and early 19th century encores grew out of a more freewheeling era for concert etiquette. When audiences called for one at the premiere of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, the Allegretto received a second hearing, but mid-show encores posed a larger test for opera houses. As Theodore Fenner details in Opera in London, impresarios and critics found them vulgar and intrusive, but also a statistical gauge of public taste. As a Times reviewer noted in 1791, John Bull will perhaps think it extraordinary that during the evening there did not occur one encore. Encore practice was more tightly controlled in royal theaters, where only a monarch or his deputy could demand one. When Cimarosa's comedy Il Matrimonio Segreto was staged in Vienna before the Holy Roman Emperor Leopold II, the monarch was so pleased that he ordered dinner for the cast and then called for a repeat of the nearly three-hour opera, possibly the longest encore in history. In early 19th century Paris, professional claques known as biseuses were hired to hype singers by calling out for encores. Almost everyone understood their role, and prima donnas who denied audiences encores did so at their peril. When German soprano Gertrude Elisabeth Mara refused to sing one in a 1785 performance at King's Theater, the audience angrily hissed. A Times reviewer took her side, arguing that the airs should not be bravoed till the symphony be closed. But when Mara refused again in 1793, the Times this time decided she was very properly hissed for refusing. More often, divas embraced show-stopping moments. During a Metropolitan Opera touring production of Gounod's Roméo et Juliette in Boston in 1895, an upright piano was wheeled onto the stage so that soprano Nellie Melba could sing her encore. When soprano Marcella Sembrich was called back for multiple encores during Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor in Washington, D.C., even the musicians dropped their instruments, stood up in their seats, and cried, "Bravo," reported the Washington Evening Star. By the 1910s, conductors including Arturo Toscanini had seen enough and refused to grant singers their starry moment, thus marking a decline in the practice. The Met drew a line with a chaotic 1924 production of Flotow's Martha. As the audience called on tenor Beniamino Gigli to repeat the aria Ma Pari, conductor Gennaro Pappi pressed ahead with the next scene, even as Gigli was still returning for more bows. The words, "Positively no encores allowed," began appearing in capital letters in programs. Both Milan's La Scala and the Met finally relaxed their encore policies in 2007 and 2008, respectively, when tenor Juan Diego Flores was invited to repeat the high C-laden tenor aria from Donizetti's La Fille du Raisonnement. An earlier thought, the Met, came in 1994 when Luciano Pavarotti repeated an aria in Tosca. These moments drew both excitement and some renewed tutting. In lifting official prohibitions and traditional restraints, hasn't the Met let a monster out of the bottle? Asked Newsday theater critic Linda Weiner. If tonight's audience gets an encore, won't tomorrow's feel cheated if they just get a fine performance? Without the encores, does it mean that the other guy saw a better show? Encores are usually plotted carefully and repeated over the course of a performance run or tour. In an era of strict contracts, union rules, and licensing restrictions, venues are actively involved in encore preparation to ensure a smooth and timely finish. Yet, among pianists, encore policies vary. Arthur Schnabel detested them, while Evgeny Kisin dispensed 12 encores at the 2007 Carnegie Hall recital. Sergei Rachmaninoff would always signal that he was done for the night by playing his prelude in C-sharp minor, "A new composition by myself," he said, in a sarcastically theatrical voice, before one Philadelphia performance, suggesting that he had grown weary of the ritual. At Carnegie Hall in 1918, Rachmaninoff disappointed the flappers in the balconies by denying them the prelude. "All of flapperdom sorrowed last night," snorted the New York Times' James Gibbons Huneker, "for there are amiable fanatics who follow this pianist from place to place, hoping to hear him in this particular prelude, like the Englishman who attended every performance of the Lady Lion Tamer, hoping to see her swallowed by one of her pets." Some of history's most attention-getting encores have doubled as social or political statements. Daniel Barenboim and the Berlin Staatskapelle used the humble encore in 2001 as a way to introduce the prelude to Tristan and Isolde to Israel, breaking with the country's unofficial Wagner ban and setting off a tempest, with some audience members shouting epithets and walking out. Other performers have displayed a more relaxed side through their encores. Pianist Gabriela Montero, known for her improvisation skills, has improvised encores based on themes requested or sung by audience members. Violinist Pekka Kuusisto has played and sang jaunty Finnish folk songs, even leading an audience sing-along at the BBC Proms in 2016. And fellow fiddler Hilary Hahn, tired of trotting out familiar pieces, commissioned short encores for violin and piano from 26 composers, then held an online competition to choose a 27th. Perhaps as more artists rethink performance conventions in this unsettled era, the spontaneity of a well-executed encore can make its way into the formal part of programs. Then again, there's the old show business maxim: always leave audiences wanting more. We asked two of today's performing soloists how they handle encores. First, Johannes Moser, cellist. "These days I tend to play an encore with the whole cello section after a concerto, such as Pablo Casals' Song of the Birds, or the second movement of Grieg's Holberg Suite, arranged for six cellos. Often a concerto is more like a symphony with a solo part, so rather than pushing the rest of the orchestra aside in the encore, it's nice to be more inclusive. Encore choices may have changed in recent years as the role of the soloist is changing. There's no longer that singular star cult. Instead, the soloist is a kind of ambassador between the orchestra and the public. The encore becomes an opportunity to make a statement about how you view your role in that context." Henning Kragerud, violinist. "Once during a tour, I realized that I had forgotten to prepare an encore, so I decided instead to trust in my ability to improvise a straight from the heart. It worked out so well that I often now improvise as an introduction to the main pieces in my concert programs. I take the harmonic progression from the central work, or any other appropriate elements, and improvise over them. In this way, I'm not just performing the work of the composer, I'm a co-creator. Our reverence for classical repertoire can sometimes feel a bit like a religion, because encores form a less regulated part of the concert. They present the opportunity for greater creativity." In the April 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, we get to interview up-and-coming countertenor John Holliday. Where were you born? Rosenberg, which is a suburb of Houston, Texas. What would be your career highlight? Being able to share music on NBC's The Voice. In my classical career, my highlights have involved bringing new opera to the world. Jonathan Dove's Flight, Daniel Bernard Romain's We Shall Not Be Moved, Hoang Ro's Paradise Interrupted, and Matthew O'Quinn's Eurydice. Who would be your musical hero? Derek Lee Regan, the first African-American countertenor to grace the stage of the Metropolitan Opera. As with soprano Leontine Price and mezzo-soprano Denise Graves, there is an artistry and truth in his performances. What would be your dream concert? To have the John Holliday experience at Madison Square Garden. The opening of the Sydney Opera House happened nearly 50 years ago. In the BBC Music magazine for October 2021, we get a vivid description of that momentous musical event. October is springtime in Sydney, Australia, and the weather can be unreliable. But by mid-afternoon on the 20th of October, 1973, a bank of ominous gray clouds had given way to bright blue skies and wafts of cotton ball cumulus. A strong breeze was blowing, however, as Queen Elizabeth II stepped from a ceremonial Rolls Royce with the Duke of Edinburgh and ascended a dais to declare Sydney's architecturally stunning new opera house open. Wearing a silken dress of duck egg blue and matching hat? Not unlike an inverted sail of the opera house, one observer commented. The monarch gripped the pages of her script tightly as wind buffeted the platform. The speech itself was not without irony. I understand that its construction has not been totally without problems, the Queen said, referring to the majestic edifice before her. Australians, famed for wit as dry as their national outback country, no doubt appreciated this royal piece of understatement. The Sydney Opera House project, nearly two decades in the making, had in fact been dogged with controversy from the outset. A competition to design the building was launched in 1956, and the choice of Danish architect Jørn Utzon as winner was divisive. Some loved his futuristic white sails in the sunshine conception. Others derided its system of interlocking vaulted shells as drastically impractical. The naysayers had a point. Construction began in 1959, but was dogged by delays and cost overruns, many caused by the complexity of Utzon's design. Originally scheduled to end in 1963, the building was eventually completed 10 years later. The overspend, too, was eye-popping. $102 million was the final bill, compared to an initial $7 million estimate. Utzon, weary of the endless wrangling, resigned from the project in 1966 and declined an invitation to the opening ceremony. But on that October day in 1973, all those tribulations were forgotten. 60,000 balloons soared skyward over Sydney Harbor, pigeons and white doves were released, and 1 million people thronged the city's public places. Marching bands filed through the streets, and atop the opera house, an Aboriginal actor narrated a reminder that the shoreline site was once inhabited by Indigenous Australians. The building itself had already hosted its first performances. Prokofiev's War and Peace was staged on the 28th of September in the 1,500-seat Opera Theatre, since renamed the Joan Sutherland Theatre, after the famous Australian soprano. A day later, in the adjoining concert hall, Charles McCarris conducted an all-Wagner program with the great Swedish soprano Birgit Nilsson. The Queen herself attended the performances of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and Mozart's The Magic Flute, and was greeted by children in koala, kangaroo, and monkey costumes. In the near half-century since Sydney Opera House's opening, much has been written about its design flaws, the concert hall's acoustics. They would do an aeroplane hangar a disservice, the actor John Malkovich reckoned. Were particularly problematic, and the hall is currently closed for improvements. The Joan Sutherland Theater has also drawn opprobrium. Inadequate for opera, in Scottish director David McVicar's judgment, with a cramped orchestra pit and limited backstage areas. Some of these shortcomings were addressed in a 2017 renovation. Yet Sydney Opera House remains hugely popular with the public, nearly 11 million of whom visit it annually. And architecturally, it is now a recognized classic. One of the indisputable masterpieces of human creativity was UNESCO's verdict in declaring the building a World Heritage Site in 2007. Not only in the 20th century, but in the history of humankind. In the April 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, we're reading about the moment Handel's Messiah premiered by Terry Blaine. Last Wednesday, the celebrated Dr. Handel arrived here in the packet boat from Holyhead, a gentleman universally known by his excellent compositions in all kinds of music. So ran a short news announcement in the Dublin Journal, days after Handel's disembarkment in the city on the 18th of November, 1741. What was Handel doing in Dublin, when for 30 years London had been his main center of operations? It was possibly the Duke of Devonshire, Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, who invited him. If so, it was a timely intervention. Handel's last three operas had failed, and he was at a low ebb both personally and professionally. 2 months before leaving London, Handel had completed Messiah, a new oratorio on the life of Christ and its theological significance. The author of its text, Charles Jennens, came to London in late November 1741, apparently to get an update from Handel on the Messiah project. But it was some mortification to me to hear that instead of performing it here, he was gone into Ireland with it, he wrote tetchily. Messiah was not, however, the first piece Handel presented in Dublin. In a subscription series of six musical entertainments at the recently built New Music Hall in Fishamble Street, L'Allegro, Il Penseroso ed Il Moderato, Acis in Galatea, and Esther were among the vocal works performed to great acclaim. A second series of six concerts in February 1742 was equally successful. At this point, Handel, riding a wave of acclamation from his Dublin audience, finally unpacked his score of Messiah. A charity premiere was mooted for relief of the prisoners in the several jails of Dublin and for two hospitals. This occurred on the 13th of April, 1742, at the same hall used for the subscription series. The performance began at noon and was packed beyond the venue's normal capacity of 600. To squeeze an extra 100 in, women were asked to come without hoops in their dresses and gentlemen without their swords. Around 30 to 40 performers took part. Most of the singers borrowed from Dublin's St. Patrick's and Christchurch cathedrals, and with strings, trumpets, and timpani in the orchestra. Handel himself accompanied on an organ, perhaps his own imported from London. Messiah's premiere that April afternoon was ecstatically received by the Lords Justices and a vast assembly of the nobility and gentry of both sexes who attended. Words are wanting to express the exquisite delight it accorded, reported the Dublin Journal. The contralto Susanna Chibbers aria, "He Was Despised," drew particular attention from the Reverend Patrick Delaney, knowing Chibber had recently been entangled in an adulterous affair in London. He exclaimed, "Woman, for this be all thy sins forgiven thee." Financially, Messiah was also highly successful. Tickets were half a guinea each, and £400 in total, worth nearly £100,000 today, was raised for the three charities. A second performance was added on the 3rd of June, this time for the composer's own benefit, and billed as the last performance of Mr. Handel's during his stay in this kingdom. Handel left Ireland 2 months later, planning to return. He never did, but always retained fond memories of that generous and polite nation. The feeling is mutual. Every 13th of April since 1992, a choir has gathered on the spot where Messiah was first performed in Fishamble Street to perform selections from his masterwork. The original New Music Hall eventually became an engineering works before being leveled for residential development. Only its archway remains standing today. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, with generous support from Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me next week for more fascinating articles on Classical Music Connection.